Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Mayhem in the money markets has its own exotic vocabulary of panics and bubbles, terms to be translated like short selling, squeezes, and hoaxes like trades without commissions or pump and dump tricks of the traders. Our first reflex is to summon the straight-talking Scotsman, Mark Blyth, political economist at Brown University, and ask him to decode, for example, the populist lingo around the GameStop spectacle on Wall Street, Robin Hood, and the day traders against the institutional sharks and vampire squid of high finance. We'll get to the history of modern money politics with Zachary Carter, biographer of the great John Maynard Keynes, also with Matt Taibbi on the shaky journalism around GameStop, and then with the Olympian economist Joseph Stiglitz. But first, the Gabby professor himself, Mark Blyth. We always picture him coming home and telling his hometown pub crowd in Glasgow or Dundee what's really going on. What's the chance, I asked him this week, of market madness triggering a 1929 sort of depression?
The better analogy is 1924. You've just had a failed coup d'etat. The people who did it are being widely ridiculed. And you've got 5 years to stop 29 happening.
Oh. Mark Blyth, welcome back. The guys in the pub are dying, and the gals too, dying to hear. We're worried about our man so close to the shark tank. What the hell is going on? What's serious? What's not?
Where do you want to start? I mean, it's such an interesting topic. So you're talking like GameStop and then it's spilling into silver, populism in the marketplace, Angrynomics hits the stock market. Where do you want to go with it, Chris?
Well, first, the irony of the games. The game stores, the video game stores, are being gamed to death and maybe back to life by the real gamers, the new gamers, and the old bad gamers. I don't know. I can't get the Shark Tank out of my head.
So here's the thing. Along comes Robinhood. Robinhood is a fee-free broker. Basically, you know, how do you then make your money? Well, you make your money because what they do is they sell the order flow to other people, particularly to a hedge fund spin-off company called Citadel Capital, right?
Right.
So here's how this works. You get your Robinhood up. You then put in your details, your bank account. You chuck in your $20 and you say you want to buy GameStop. The person who executes that order is not the broker. It's not the platform. It's the guy who's in Citadel Capital. Now, they pay for the right to do the orders. Sometimes they'll execute the orders with other people as well. But what they're really paying for is they want to know what Chris wants to buy.
Excellent.
And they want to know what all the Chris's in the world want to buy.
Right, trending. That's
right, because that gets them ahead of the curve, right? Now, the illegal version of this is called front running, and that's when you basically delay people's trades and trade on your own book and make the money because you know the order flow is coming in. And Citadel has, in fact, been fined last year $700,000 and admitted no wrongdoing for doing exactly that, which is a bit like you getting fined 25 cents for parking in a disabled zone and admitting no wrongdoing, right? But the practice of selling order flow is not in itself illegal if you don't do that with it, which then begs the question, well, why else would you be buying the order flow? So basically, all of the optics on this look bad, right? Then comes the thing that sends everybody mental. It turns out that Robinhood immediately starts saying, oh, hang on, this is going too high. You can't buy this anymore. You're driving it up too far. You can only sell it. But that wasn't true for the professional investors. They could still buy and sell. So this is when Dave Portnoy from Barstool Sports goes online and goes viral, calling them all sorts of names. This is when AOC and Ted Cruz get together and go, what's up? There's this asymmetry, right? Whereby the little guy can only sell because it's now convenient for the big guys, right? And again, the optics on this look absolutely terrible. Then that spreads to other platforms, but there's such an outcry that it loosens up and then people pile back in again, right? So this shows that Wall Street's are a game and it shows that the people have the power, right? That's the story, right? Okay, how could that story be seriously wrong? Right, well, let's start this way. How does this end? This always ends badly with the little guy who's pumped it all the way up losing his shirt as the professional investors clean up. Now, one of the people that has the biggest position in GameStop is a hedge fund that you've never heard of. That's one of the most successful in the world. It's got Eugene Fama, the famous economist, on his board. And they've held GameStop since the beginning of the run-up. And then you know that they've sold at the top and they're already out. The people that are left holding the bag are all the people who have been told to hold this and hold the line and we're fighting the good guys. We have seen this loads of times before. It's called a pump and dump. Now, it doesn't matter if like there's no real organization, no nefarious guy who's leading everybody off the edge of the cliff, if it's just a collective mania. But the result is the same. Everybody who bought in at 180 expecting it to stay there is going to lose. So just to finish all this off, Chris, right? We've seen this before. It ends badly for the little guy. We want to maintain market integrity because if this goes south completely and infects lots of different markets, we could be looking at systemically important things failing.
Let me just say, the best thing you've done for me lately, Mark, is refer me to this Better Markets website.
Yeah.
Sort of public interest, sort of vaguely Ralph Nader-ish consumer guide. But they describe this world as a vast predatory ecosystem underpinning modern finance. Is that true? Is it the shark tank it looks like?
Is this a shark tank? Of course it's a shark tank. The rules are well established. It's for other sharks. But is it corrupt or is it a rigged game? Well, yeah. I mean, basically, if you're paying for order flow, what you're doing is you're front-running your customers. You're trying to get ahead of the market. You're not acting in the interests of your customer. You're basically executing trades on your own account and getting in front of it and making money. That's at the very least market abuse, right? Under certain definitions of it, you could even say that it's insider trading, right? Now, you know, this stuff, you don't have markets without conflicts of interest. You don't have markets without people gaming it. You also don't have markets without failure. I mean, here's an interesting thing. My co-author, Eric Lonergan, who is, at full disclosure, is a hedge fund manager, pointed out. In the first quarter of last year, over 250 hedge funds went bust. They go bust all the time. That's the sharks eating the sharks, right? So in a sense, it's a question of what's your perspective of what a normal market looks like, right? If it is one in which sophisticated investors try and rip each other's face off all the time, which we saw in popular representations like The Big Short and all the rest of it, then we shouldn't be surprised. If our model is that, like, you know, you can download an app and with no risk at all buy options and everything will turn out fine, then you're being an idiot under any circumstances. And perhaps to me the most disturbing thing is when AOC gets involved in this, and one of the most progressive voices in American politics seems to think that it's somehow progressive to allow people who really are newbies to basically lever themselves up with instruments they don't understand.
Right.
And that is a right of access. I don't know. I'd prefer that she was working on taxing the rich rather than basically enabling the poor to gamble multiples of their income.
Speaking of taxing the rich, part of the lesson of the spectacle in the last few years, and I wonder if it's different from 1929, is that we can have a rich man's boom in the stock market and a people's depression for a long, long time, and they don't seem to meet. And the destruction of the boom market wouldn't do any much good for the people who are living, not paycheck to paycheck, sort of, handout to handout.
Chris, but let me put this simply. Nearly 60% of Americans earn less than $20 an hour. They're not involved in the stock market, right? This is a rich person's game.
Right.
And the second great myth is the stock market exists for companies to raise capital. No, it's not. Most companies use retained earnings for their investment. And they use the stock market to do things like buy back their own stock to boost the value of it. So the whole thing is, it depends on what you think the purpose is. If you think this is kind of a portfolio allocation game for the rich to bet on various indices and various companies to become even more rich, and that's it, then yeah, the stock market's awesome. But that also explains why it has nothing to do with the real economy, right? Why most people are excluded from it. If you think that this is this engine of prosperity, that's never been true. I'll give you the numbers from 1929. I just did a class on it yesterday. Galbraith's estimates on this was there were about 123 million people in the United States in 1929. And there were between 50 and 60,000 professional investors or semi-professional investors involved in the crash. So a tiny, tiny fraction of the population caused the bust that brought down the economy.
Right.
So when people talk about, hey, but the stock market and the real economy are you know, distant from each other, They always have been. Right? I mean, there may have been some golden age in the 1950s when, you know, you were gifted GM shares by your grandma and you held them to, you know, you held them until you died, right? But now your average stock is held for less than a day. It's all trading. It's all momentum. It's literally, this is what the thing is.
Where does the gaming, the wheel spinning, the indecision, the direction of things put us in the world economy?
So it's worrisome from the following point of view. The reason that the United States continues to grow faster than other rich countries is partly because it's got tech companies that everyone else doesn't, and they control certain technologies, etc., which means they get a lot of the growth and they benefit from global supply chains and all this sort of stuff. But the other main reason is because lots of foreigners put their money in the United States to earn more in the US stock market than they get at home.
Right.
If you basically screw that up, then they'll stop lending us the money. And if they stop lending us the money and stop investing, then the dollar has a real wake-up moment. And suddenly all those big policies that we've been doing, which have been sort of self-harm for decades, enormous defense budgets for no apparent reason, you know, all the rest of it, will come home to roost. And our ability to run unlimited debts and deficits might fall into question, at which point we'd actually have to make some real hard choices about people paying taxes and corporations, God forbid, actually paying taxes. So there's a way in which, you know, you could game this out and imagine GameStop moves successfully onto silver, they corner the silver market. This becomes a question of market integrity. Foreign investors no longer believe that the American stock market is the place to be. European stocks start to go up. The Europeans realize this is a moment where they could finally issue a mutual bond to rival dollar debt. They do this. You can imagine a situation whereby if that isn't patched up very quickly, within 2 to 3 years, things could really begin to shift. But, you know, they probably won't. Because what will happen is the SEC will come in and it will basically calm down the current situation. I pretty much think in 2 weeks' time, nobody will be talking about GameStop and all the rest of it. And certain practices will either be banned or there'll be congressional hearings. People will be put on the naughty step. They will be fined notional amounts of money. Robin Hood will become a byword for bad tech. People will be disappointed and we will continue on with what we're doing.
Everybody in the pub wants to buy around. In honor of you, we just want to say thank you and come back soon. This is important, and you make me feel a little bit better already.
Well, if I made you feel a bit better, Chris, I'm obviously not doing my job.
Coming up, the almost alien worlds of stock market trading and real capital development. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Zachary Carter wrote a celebrated biography of the most quoted economist of the age, the late John Maynard Keynes. He's reminding us of Keynes's personal pleasure in gambling and his professional disregard of market gaming, as in the GameStop case.
I think this particular debacle, moment of unrest, is unlikely to trigger a crisis akin to the stock market crash of 1929. There were so many banks that were involved in the stock market at that time that the losses that were taken ended up impacting the ability of these banks to lend money into the general economy. John Maynard Keynes in 1936 wrote his magnum opus, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. And he said, speculators may do no harm as bubbles on a steady stream of enterprise, but the position is serious when enterprise becomes the bubble on a whirlpool of speculation. And I think this part is really critical. When the capital development of a country becomes a byproduct of the activities of a casino, the job is likely to be ill done.
That sentence just rings with care and experience and study. What exactly does that mean? And I forgot we had casinos in the 1930s. Of course we did.
Yes, we did. Well, Keynes was someone who was speaking from personal experience. He was a bit of a gambler. He liked gambling. He even said that a little bit of gambling was sort of a healthy psychological disposition for people. But he also believed that gambling in general sort of indulged the worst habits of human beings if taken to excess. So he said casinos should be very expensive and very remote.
Go back to that sentence. Mm-hmm. Capital development by way of a casino is a bad idea. Is that where we are? Or is that casino really overrated in our capital development or idle in our capital development?
The trick with the current GameStop mania is that the stock market as such is not particularly related to the capital development of the United States or the global economy. Not a whole lot of investment, you know, the financing of new equipment, new research, new workers is done through the stock market. Most companies, nearly all companies, finance their operations through retained earnings or through bank loans or through capital markets, which I would distinguish from the stock market. So they would sell debt rather than sell equity on the stock market. What's important about the Keynesian observation is that speculative mentality is still there in the other markets for credit and debt, which really are important to the capital development of the United States. And there's no particularly compelling reason to believe that a lot of gamblers are going to come to the right answer if you just get more of them involved. It's sort of the populists rising up against the sort of old dinosaurs and democratizing the financial system. I think the idea of democratizing finance in this way, you should view with a great deal of skepticism. Keynes would not talk about democratizing finance. He would talk about democratizing investment.
Keynes, of course, is a byword for public investment, state regulation, the state's role in the largest definition of the economy. When you look at ours today and you see huge unmet needs, obviously in the climate department, transportation, internet management, public communication, where would he be looking for the initiative, not to mention the money?
Keynes was always focused not on particular policy tools, but on the sort of big picture social problems that needed to be addressed. In his day, this was war and depression. I think in our own time, the big social problems that are staring us in the face involve inequality, functional dangers with globalization, and the fragility of supply chains, which I think have been revealed by the COVID-19 pandemic. And then the very obvious and scientifically unambiguous threat of climate change. And Keynes would say, if you want to solve big problems, you have to get people together in a room and try to solve the problems. You do not get a whole bunch of gamblers together and have them bet on who can best solve the problem. Over the last 30 to 40 years in the United States, we've sort of lionized this ideal of the investor as the person who knows best about not only what will make him or her money, but what will be good for society. And Keynes just never took that idea seriously at all.
You don't think he'd look at the Robin Hood executives and say, that's my kind of people to manage the climate crisis?
I think that's right. I don't think Keynes would look at the Robin Hood folks and say they're going to lead us to the promised land. And there is a sort of moral idealism to Keynes's work. He really does want to make the world a better place, and he views the problems of his day as deeply serious on a deep kind of emotional level. He's not just talking about productivity and profit. But the great developments historically of American capitalism have not been fostered by speculative investors or even, you know, the market or the private sector at all. You have huge shifts that happen at certain periods of time that are sponsored by the state. The beginning of the United States economy, it's an agricultural economy.
It's a cotton economy, right?
Exactly. And the American economy's advantage in the cotton market is that its labor is free, the practice of slavery. Once slavery is abolished, the United States industrializes. Essentially, the government is sponsoring the railroad industry. Mm-hmm. And the railroad industry involves not only actual trains, but oil, coal, iron, steel, a state enterprise that is being fostered by the United States.
And of course, in my lifetime, the interstate highway system.
The interstate highway system, clearly a development of the Eisenhower administration operating on a sort of Keynesian model. And then in my generation, the development of the internet. I mean, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs didn't think this up in their garage. Mm. Bill Gates and Steve Jobs figured out how to make money off of this technology that had been built by the federal government. And so that investment that really changes the way the world works is always something that's a matter of public policy. And there are always public funds and public incentives that are being created to enable these things to happen. And when we look at our problem state, I think what's really telling about the GameStop fracas is that there's no sense in which any of this is tied to any particular public purpose or social problem. Mm. No one thinks the GameStop day traders are going to solve climate change for us. And the only reason we invest this particular moment with great economic significance is because for the last 20 or 30 years, the state just hasn't done the kind of investment that is necessary to solve the problems of today. And the reason people are cautious about state investment is because a lot of times the state investment is bad. I mean, slavery was bad. The railroads were corrupt, but change has never happened any other way. It always comes through the state.
It's so interesting. I wonder myself if the Republicans' party line genuinely believes that enterprise is going to solve or deal with the climate problem in general. But take those three things we've outlined: rebuilding the energy grid, rebuilding the transportation grid, railways, highways, and then also the information grid, the internet. You picture the state as first mover here. What might it be doing?
Well, I think on the information side, we have to ask ourselves whether this enormous cloud computing technology sector needs to be controlled by a handful of large corporations, you know, Google, Amazon. That seems just inherently unstable and dangerous. On transportation, I went to Taipei, the capital of Taiwan, and just rode the subway. And I had ridden many subways in the United States, in Washington, D.C., and in San Francisco, in New York, in Boston. And I thought I knew what riding the subway was like. You get on the subway in Taipei, it's a completely different experience. Everything is quick, it's quiet, it's clean. People get in line, there's no delays, the trains show up on time. And then they get you where you want to go without any trouble. And the idea that you're not just sort of rolling the dice when you get on the subway and just saying, well, we'll see where the day takes us, that is a completely alien experience to people living in Taiwan. In New York, you know, you get on the subway, you might get to work on time, you might have the worst day of your life. there's no way to know. And that type of public investment, it's just there in other countries. They just do it. And we could do that not only with the subways in the United States, but with green energy, with sustainable investment in the foundations of industry. In Taiwan, they've had a much more effective way of dealing with the pandemic than we have here in the United States, where we are very skeptical of federal action. I don't want to say federal power, because solving a pandemic is not necessarily an act of aggression. But they live in a democracy under the shadow of an authoritarian government just right across the water. And yet they've had 7 deaths from COVID-19 so far. And we've, you know, we have 7 deaths an hour in the county where I live. So there has to be some way in the United States for us to organize resources, use the state to solve problems. And using the state to solve problems doesn't lead inevitably to being the USSR or China. Now, figuring out how to do that is no small task, but there's no other way forward. There just isn't a role for the sort of casino of financial speculation to solve problems like this. They never have, and there's no reason to believe it ever will.
Zachary Carter, you make the point very concisely and well. Thank you. Thank you again for your book on Keynes, but thank you for this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Matt Taibbi is an all-purpose adventurer who emerged in the 2008 financial crisis as the gonzo journalist on Wall Street. His model at Rolling Stone magazine was the late Hunter Thompson, but his hero further back was the satirical sage of Baltimore in the 1930s, H.L. Mencken. Matt Taibbi, in his popular newsletter, has helped make GameStop a story of class. So who do we root for?
It's not really a question of rooting for or against. The only thing I can say for sure is that the horrified reaction by everybody on Wall Street saying this is an outrage and that these people don't know what they're doing and they have to stay grounded in quote-unquote fundamentals and that they're going to get hurt if they keep doing that, that's completely disingenuous. There's a reason why everybody's taking pleasure in the downfall of these short sellers who are wagging their fingers at these amateurs, because it's the same thing that they've been doing forever.
It's one of these crises that makes you incredibly aware of who's telling the story. In the New York Times, these pirates are not just the dumb money, they are the foul-mouthed misfits, they keep calling them. Foul-mouthed being a big sin. What can you tell about the telling of this story, Matt?
First of all, the New York Times bashing the GameStop bettors and the Reddit people has found out this hilarious. If anybody who's worked on Wall Street would disclose what those chat between professional traders, it's just as bad, if not worse, than anything that goes on in Wall Street bets. There are things that have gone on in very reputable banks that are just as bad, if not worse, than Wall Street bets. So it's a big class issue with the way they're telling the story. The people who are making these bets are, by and large, ordinary retail investors, day traders, and therefore they're not considered reputable, and they're being described that way.
You're right this week. The only dangerous thing about a gang of Reddit investors blowing up hedge funds is that some of us reading about it may die of laughter.
I have to point out, it's not something necessarily to be celebrated when a hedge fund or any big investor takes a bath on an investment. But the arrogance and the pretensions of these traders to say that this is their birthright alone to do this kind of activity and going to cry to the press when they get beaten. Mm-hmm. You know, this is something that they do to everybody else. It's laughable.
There's another story that just intrigues me, and that is the sort of emotional trickle down of all this. Reading about ourselves with a brand new administration, an incredible agenda of public crises, climate above all. And here we are watching gamesters play games with other people's money, making most of us feel that the strength of the country has become irrelevant.
Yeah, I think part of what makes the GameStop story so compelling for everybody is that we have to be in a pretty advanced state of decline and collective depression for people to respond to the story and laugh at it as though it's something enjoyable. I mean, in a normal country, something like this wouldn't happen, where you would have enormous quantity of people getting together and actively betting up the value of a stock that they probably know in the end isn't worth a whole lot, just to spite somebody and to make some money, to be fair. They are actually trying to squeeze these short sellers. But the emotional aspect of it is really, it's satirical in a way that only makes sense to a country in an advanced state of frustration, decline, and helplessness. It's a kind of a gallows humor situation.
Mm. There's another story here that fascinates me, and it's the Matt Taibbi story. This well-educated traveler, adventurer in many modes, including professional sports in the Far East, arriving at Rolling Stone during the 08 crisis, and coining that incredible phrase of the great vampire, describing Goldman Sachs. I have to read it. A great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. You drew some important lines there, Matt, and it's made you an important commentator, not just on Wall Street, but on us.
First of all, the funny thing about that is that line almost didn't happen because I didn't get it through fact-checking, because vampire squids don't have blood funnels. But really, the underlying story of the 2008 financial crisis is one that I think has become the dominant storyline of our time, whether we're talking about finance or politics, which is this creeping sense that the system is systematically unfair, that it's rigged in the favor of certain people, and that there's a separate sets of rules for the rich and for the poor. And that was absolutely the subtext of the entire 2008 financial crisis, both what went on before and what happened after, when none of the people who committed crimes were punished or any of those things. You could make a very strong argument that it had a lot to do with the Trump phenomenon, the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, and a lot of the frustrations that are going on now. It's really all the same story. I do think that there's a lot more consciousness about flaws in the system, and especially sort of structural inequities that are built into the way the economy is built. The problem is that we've had political opportunists like Trump come along, and one of his favorite lines was to talk about how the system is rigged. Well, you know, he wasn't entirely wrong, which is unfortunate, because that criticism became infamous, I think, in part because of Trump. But it's an observation that you see universally across the political spectrum when you cover presidential elections. I think the whole country is now aware that something is deeply wrong with the way society is organized, but they are frustrated and they can't find a way to articulate it in the exactly way that they feel will be effective. And that's why things like GameStop happen, is because people see an opening and all those frustrations just go pouring in there, because they see something to do about it. And I think that's going to continue.
I wonder why we don't have a grip on it. Whose line was it that there is no way in American life to vote against Goldman Sachs? We just had a presidential election campaign that flirted with the wealth issues, with Elizabeth Warren's argument from the left that the system is rigged. And here we are again, though.
One of the things that was frustrating with the presidential election coverage last year is that the class issue is just, it's still mostly taboo in the American media. We just don't really discuss it. If you turn on, you know, CNN, MSNBC, you'll see 100 stories before you see stories about the growing class divide, the fact that the only group in American society to see an overall increase in wealth since 2008 has been the upper 20% of society. Right. Every other group has seen declines, some of them quite pronounced, which has never happened over this length of time in American history, in modern American history anyway. And for that to not be a dominant news story in this climate is kind of incredible, because it is the story for most people in this country. It's been frustrating to watch that we still can't get it in front and center in the national conversation.
Robert Reich is getting famous just in the last few days for saying that the billionaire growth of ownership and wealth since COVID, over $1 trillion, is much more than enough to pay for the whole Joe Biden social program and leave those billionaires as rich as they were a year ago. How do we talk about this, Matt? How do we avoid talking about it?
I don't know how we avoid talking about it. And he's absolutely right. You could add on all the money that all the financial companies made underwriting all the debt issuance from the bailout. They had an unbelievable year. Financial companies, the top 20 hedge funds, had the best year that they've had in a decade. They're making an enormous sum of money. And so it's essentially a tax that the very wealthy are taking from the rest of society that they're keeping. And, you know, people are clued into this and they say, well, I can't afford food or medicine, or if I get sick, I'm going to be bankrupt. How is that fair? And they look at companies like Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs that are doing record numbers, and they get really, really angry really fast. And it's hard to not feel some sympathy for that. And that's going to continue until somebody addresses the issue.
Stick with the story. We read your newsletter religiously, Matt Taibbi. And thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, the unfinished business of the country, as JFK put it. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Joseph Stiglitz at Columbia University is a colossus of Keynesian proportions in reformist economics. He's an embattled thinker, researcher, writer in every corner of his science. He's been in and out of the big economic jobs in the White House and internationally. He won the Nobel Prize 20 years ago, and he's still a critical whirlwind. I asked him, what's for us to learn in the GameStop story?
The big lesson is that stock market prices don't have anything to do with the real world. It used to be a rich person's gambling casino. Now we've democratized it and probably made it even more unstable. My concern actually is that at the end of the day, the big guys are going to fleece the little guys once again.
For me, the question that arises is when and how and why and at what price did our economy become so financialized? It's all about quick trades, instant trades, and making absolutely nothing in the one of the great manufacturing miracles of world history.
Yeah, there's been this process of sometimes called financialization.
Exactly.
It began around 1980, 40 years ago. There was a process of deregulating the financial markets. If you go back in history, the Great Depression highlighted the excesses of the financial markets during the Roaring 20s. There were these things of short sales, like we just saw in GameStop. There were all kinds of financial shenanigans that went on. And one of the things that happened after President Roosevelt took office, Congress, administration looked at what had set off this terrible Great Depression. And one part of it, it's only one part, but one part was financialization. Introduced regulations on banks. They introduced the Securities and Exchange Commission. They tried to create, you might call it, a level playing field and a well-regulated playing field. And we kept that framework for, you know, 40 years. And it served us well. We didn't have another major economic downturn until the end of the 80s. But when Reagan took office, there was this whole agenda of liberalization, financialization, and unleashing markets from the regulations that they claimed were dampening the economy. Well, we've now had 40 years of that new experiment, as I'll call it. What we've seen is exactly what you said. The real economy has not done very well. After we, quote, liberalized and unleashed the economy, growth actually slowed down. And I think part of the reason is exactly what you're hinting at. What happened was, rather than devoting more resources, human talent, which is really our most scarce resource,
yes,
to making better products, meeting the needs of ordinary citizens in a better way, more and more the talent, as it were, went into extracting profits out of financialization.
Yeah, it's at moments like this that we reflect with a real pang. Wait a second, we used to make stuff. You wrote a book that I admired, Globalization and Its Discontents. Could you give us the 3-minute version of financialization and its discontents and maybe its cure or remedy or what comes next?
Let me say, one of the important things is to recognize that in a modern economy, it's not only the hard things, you know, the manufactured goods, but we provide services to each other. We enjoy going out to eat.
We used to.
I happen to be in a service sector, education. And opening up people's mind is something that, you know, gives an enormous pleasure to me as a teacher, but also enormous benefit, I hope, to my students. So the healthcare sector is another service sector. So I think you need to be careful about thinking that the things that really count are the hard things like cars. As we become more aware of climate change, I think we're going to be moving more and more into a service sector economy. But the point I want to make is that there's a distinction between these things that give direct benefits to individuals, enrich their lives, give them direct happiness, and financialization. Nobody gets direct benefit from those transactions, financial transactions. They're supposed to be a means to an end. Right. And that's a really big flaw. We made them an end in ourselves. You know, I remember when people started championing, oh, our economy, look at the growth of the financial sector. And I said, we should be worried about that because the financial sector is an intermediary. Nobody eats, enjoys finance, except means, as I said, to an end. And what we saw in the years before the 2008 crisis, as the financial sector grew and grew and grew from about 2.5% of GDP to reaching 6%, 7%, 8%, economic performance overall decreased. And we finally saw the real consequence was not more growth, but more instability and more inequality.
Joe Stiglitz, a few minutes ago, Zachary Carter, who wrote a wonderful biography of John Maynard Keynes, was making the point that a cousin of what you were just saying, that the stock market is not the root of our prosperity or our wealth or our well-being or almost anything. He was saying that Keynesian point, that transformative capital development comes out of states and their decisions and their plans, including the railroads and canals in the 19th century and highways and the space program, even the internet and all sorts of things, including the vaccines, you could say. But from that standpoint, reset our priorities on what's got to be done.
Why do we have a higher standard of living today than we did 200, 250 years ago? And the reason basically has to do with, on the one hand, science, knowledge, learning. On the other hand, understanding how we can live together, systems of social, political, economic organization. Complex systems that work, an advanced economy that's well beyond that of the simple agricultural economy that we had 250 years ago. So let me emphasize what is really critical is the first research. And the basic research is always going to be done by government. You were talking about the vaccines. It was a marvel how quickly they were able to develop vaccines against this COVID-19. But remember, it was based on government-funded research that discovered DNA, RNA, you know, basic research. The private sector would never have done that. You know, once you do that, then the private sector can do the last mile or the last half mile or whatever.
Right.
And that's part of the you might say, the partnership between the two. But unfortunately, in the era of neoliberalism that began with President Reagan, there was a denigration of the key role that government plays in the promotion of science and learning.
And elevation, too, of the speculative side. Zachary Carter was quoting Keynes on the point that when capital development of a country becomes a byproduct of the activities of a casino, the job is likely to be ill done. But you've just put an important blessing on Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion recovery plan. You said Joe goes big, an important endorsement. Does that mean it's big enough?
Well, let's face it. There's a lot of uncertainty about COVID-19. There are the mutations going on. But my best judgment at this point, and I just want to be modest about it, is that we will tame the pandemic. You know, if most Americans are willing to get vaccinated, it will take a while for the rest of the world. And until both the pandemic has been controlled around the world and the economic aftermath is effectively dealt with, we're not going to get a full recovery. But the best judgment is that this $1.9 trillion will be, you might say, a critical point to get us going. And President Biden has emphasized that there's going to be need to be another step. That is to say, this is to enable us to recover, to make sure that we are able to recover. But we still have a lot of work ahead in constructing infrastructure and making the green transition. So when you ask, is $1.9 trillion enough? It's not enough to really address all the problems we're facing. But it is the critical amount that we need right now in response to the COVID-19 economic crisis.
Let me put it a different way, because I have no idea what's enough or what's not enough. John F. Kennedy, in the 1960 campaign, said one night in Buffalo, as it happened, he said the great purpose of the presidential contest was to remind the people of the U.S. of the unfinished business of the country. If you said, okay, folks, where are we? What do we got? There's a hole in the roof, or we haven't educated our kids, whatever. Speak of the unfinished business as you would give it an order of priority, from, you know, the climate crisis to COVID to local schools or whatever. If Joe Biden, and he might, asked you, Joe Stiglitz, rank the unfinished business of this country, what would you tell him?
You're posing the question exactly in the right way. And obviously, I would begin with a focus on the pandemic and the recovery from it. And if you look at the Biden plan, I think he's put things very much in accord with the priorities that I laid out actually in the spring. You know, the first priority, obviously, is dealing with the health crisis, making sure that vaccines are distributed, that there are tests for everybody that needs it, that there's the protective gear, that the safety regulations are being enforced in the workplace, that the schools can open up. And that means there has to be investments in our educational systems.
Right.
The second priority is, in the interim, there are a lot of people who are suffering. We need to, for instance, have extended unemployment. The United States is one of the worst unemployment insurance systems in the advanced world. It was a crime that the Trump administration did not extend unemployment insurance back in June when it was so clear that the pandemic would be with us for months and months. And so having this as part of the program is, I view, absolutely essential. This is one of those moments where, you know, if we want to make an error, let's help people at the bottom a little bit. You know, in 2017, we threw money in the hundreds and hundreds of billion dollars. We made a lot of errors, I would say, in targeting it. It all went to the billionaires and the corporations. I find it takes a lot of chutzpah for the Republicans now to be complaining that too much money is going to the middle class. And it's not needed. When they gave out so much money to the billionaires just a couple of years ago. Now, going beyond that, we need to do a major structural transformation of our economy and our society. And I list three issues: climate change, dealing with our inequality, including racial, gender, all the dimensions, and the transformation to a more knowledge-based economy, which will be the basis of our future prosperity. And our knowledge institutions have been devastated by the pandemic, and very little attention has been given to the potential long-run consequences of this.
Back to Biden. People worry about his putting the Obama alumni back into office. You surely think he needs more edge than Obama had. You didn't like a lot of Obama's stuff, especially with respect to banks and the economy. What does he need to know? What does he need to feel about the urgency of this time, including, you know, keeping the Bernie Sanders youth on the team?
Well, I think he's done some things already very resonant with that agenda. And the young people, quite rightly, feel very intensely about the issue of climate change. You know, what he's done in the last 10 days has been truly impressive. If you look at some of the issues in financial regulation, the people that he's put in charge, Gary Gensler at SEC and the new head of what's sometimes called the Elizabeth Warren Consumer Protection, are fantastic people.
How about the Elizabeth Warren and Bernie wealth tax?
I think right now he seems to be hesitant to increase taxes because he sees the weaknesses in the economy. And I think the plan is when the economy recovers and is showing some strength, that's the time to start raising the taxes. I am a supporter of the wealth tax, but I also think that you can get most of the, or at least a large fraction of the benefits through a wealth tax, of just correcting some of the distortions, eliminating the loopholes in our current tax system. For instance, we have a regressive income tax system. Those at the top pay a lower rate than those lower down. Owners of capital, returns on capital are taxed lower than people who work hard for a living. Makes absolutely no sense. We should change that. Capital gains taxes, which go mostly to the people at the very top, are taxed at a preferential rate.
I got to ask a question. Who is going to re-educate the country, including the media and the parties, on this whole business of tax cuts and what they do? They're almost automatic. We're going to cut the tax on this. Trump took it right over the cliff. I wish you'd just tell us what those tax cuts have done and left undone. You wrote the other day, America's regressive tax system has never looked uglier.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. You know, we were promised that the tax cuts for the billionaires and the corporations in December of 2017 would unleash unprecedented levels of investment. It didn't. You know, this was a naked grab for money by the rich. What they did with it was what we all anticipated. They engaged in massive share buybacks that went overwhelmingly to the top 1%. The Council of Economic Advisors of Trump said it would lead to a $4,000 increase in workers' annual wages. I thought that was laughable, and it was laughable. Wages went up a few pennies, a little bit, relative to what they otherwise would have been. But in the last year, at the bottom, it actually come down, and especially if you adjust for the risks of working, frontline workers. What was promised was not delivered.
You got to say both parties have a terrible habit to break on the reflex tax cut.
Yeah. If you ask people, what do they care about? They do care about the education of the children. They do care about access to health care. If you ask them the benefits of government responding to disasters, government supporting the research that allows for the vaccine, the government helping us get access to these vaccines, you know, these are things that are absolutely essential to our well-being. They're not free. So people understand the benefits, we haven't done as good a job at explaining if you want those benefits, you have to pay for them. If you want infrastructure, there's no free lunches, an old saw in economics. And that means that you have to have taxes to support them. And you want the taxes to be fair. And that means those who are more able to contribute and in many ways get more out of the system ought to be paying a higher share of their income in taxes.
Joseph Stiglitz, it's a great honor and pleasure to have you on our program. I can't thank you enough, both for your work and for this conversation.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks also to Matt Taibbi, Zachary Carter, and Mark Blythe. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from Paul Kahlo and Michael Garth. Mary McGrath manages our money. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.